From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, conspiracy theories. Theories about the Kennedy assassination, AIDS, the Iran-Contra scandal. We'll talk with Chip Berlay, who keeps track of conspiracy theories and monitors the extremist groups that often perpetuate these paranoid, obsessive visions. Also, what's happened to the women's movement? We talk with feminist writer Deirdre English. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the work of two linguists who died last week, S.I. Hayakawa and Dwight Bollinger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic presidential hopeful Paul Tsongas is hoping for a big win today in Maryland. Maryland is considered Tsongas's best chance to prove that he's not a regional candidate. But Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton is expected to win a majority of support among predominantly black communities. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Tsongas is favored to win the Democratic primary in Maryland. He has campaigned the most in Maryland, especially in the more affluent white counties, considered to be his base of support. While Clinton has secured powerful endorsements in Maryland, including Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoak, he has not campaigned vigorously in Maryland, focusing most of his attention on the southern states. Maryland's primaries are closed, which means Democrats and Republicans cannot cross over and vote in the other party's primary. That's one reason Republican challenger Pat Buchanan has avoided the state, because he can't count on the support of conservative Democrats and independents. Buchanan is also faced in Maryland with a tradition of moderate Republican voters who have favored President Bush in the past. Still, if voters wishing to send the White House a message, give Buchanan 30% of the vote, similar to what he accrued in South Dakota, it would be an embarrassment to the president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Colorado is holding its first ever presidential primary today in an effort to draw attention to Western issues. Democrats Paul Tsongas and Bill Clinton campaigned widely in the state, hoping a good showing in Colorado would boost their standings as national candidates. Among Republicans, President Bush was predicted to win easily over conservative challenger Patrick Buchanan. Former California Governor Jerry Brown appeared to be gaining support among Democrats by emphasizing environmental issues. Three members of an underground Islamic movement in Algeria were sentenced to death today for terrorist activities. The BBC's Jackie Rowland reports on the continuing unrest in the North African country.
A number of armed extremist groups are believed to be active in Algeria. The groups operate on the fringes of the country's Islamic fundamentalist movement, but there is little evidence to suggest that their operations are coordinated. 25 members of the underground Hezbollah movement went on trial at Tlemcen in the west of Algeria on Saturday. The court in Tlemcen passed its verdict today, finding the group guilty of premeditated murder, illegal association, hostage-taking, and the possession of arms. Three of the men were sentenced to death, while three others were given prison sentences of up to 20 years. This is the first time since the declaration of a state of emergency last month that an Algerian court has passed the death penalty on Islamic fundamentalists. The sentences seem to reflect the authorities' determination to wipe out what they describe as terrorists.
Jackie Rowland in Algiers. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at a record 3,290. This is NPR. There was more fighting today between Armenians and Azeris in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. It was heavy enough to block the withdrawal of a former Soviet Army unit that's been ordered out of the region because of repeated attacks from both sides. The Azeris and Armenians continued to accuse each other of atrocities. Researchers are trying to pinpoint what healthy adults can do to avoid developing high blood pressure. A study published in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association indicates that reducing your stress doesn't seem to help, while reducing your weight does. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
High blood pressure increases your chances of having a heart attack, a stroke, or kidney failure. Research shows you can lower high blood pressure through drugs and weight loss. But until now, no one has really looked at whether healthy people can do much, if anything, to prevent high blood pressure. That's the aim of a new study by the National Institutes of Health. The first part of the research followed over 2,000 people whose blood pressure was just on the high side of normal. Some took nutritional supplements, calcium, magnesium, potassium, or fish oil. Nothing happened. Some learned to manage their stress better. Still, no change in blood pressure. But those who lost weight or cut down on salt, their blood pressure dropped slightly. The study will now follow them for several years to see if weight loss and salt reduction really do keep them from getting high blood pressure as they age. Stay tuned. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
With the polls closed now in Georgia, two of the major television networks are now forecasting wins for President Bush and Democrat Bill Clinton in that southern state. Clinton's margin of victory is said to be strong over Tsongas in Georgia. The exit polls say that Buchanan's showing will be strong, but perhaps less than expected. A report from ABC News suggested that there may be resentment in other states against Buchanan, against Bush, that may result in a higher showing for Buchanan. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a good period for conspiracy buffs, what with the film JFK, not to mention some of the more far-fetched explanations of the Iran-Contra scandal, the October surprise, and the AIDS epidemic. My guest, Chip Raleigh, tracks conspiracy theories and their origins, and he warns against the dangers of mixing fact and fantasy. Raleigh also monitors fascist and racist groups in America. Some of those groups, he says, are where many paranoid conspiracy theories originate. Raleigh is an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, a nonprofit research organization based in Boston, which monitors the activities of extremist groups and political movements. Raleigh last joined us to discuss the New Alliance Party. I asked Chip Raleigh what he regards as a conspiracy theory.
Conspiracy theories often contain elements of fact that are provable and documentable in the long run. And the real dilemma is sorting out those conspiracies that do in fact exist, criminal conspiracies, and those theories which are in fact unsubstantiated and undocumented and reflect a kind of obsessive paranoia about control of world events by secret elites. And the real dilemma here, especially with the film JFK being so popular, is sorting out those elements of fact along with those elements that are reasonable to conclude with those elements that are just really time-honored, ultra-right-wing, you know, conspiracy theories about secret oligarchies and clubs controlling the world. And so if you look back over the last 10 years, you can see that while there have been, in fact, criminal cases and congressional hearings into conspiracies within and around the intelligence communities that were documented, there's also been a real kind of a blooming of conspiracy theories involving those very same intelligence agencies that are really quite fanciful and ultimately distract people from serious criticisms.
One of your theories is that the extreme right is spreading conspiracy theories that are being picked up by the left. And an example that you use, actually, is the film JFK.
Well, unfortunately, yes, that Mr. X, for those who saw the film, was supposedly a person with wide knowledge in the U.S. intelligence community.
This is the Donald Sutherland character.
The Donald Sutherland character, exactly. And Mr. X was, in fact, based on a researcher named Fletcher Prouty, who wrote a book, which was quite a good book some years ago in the 70s, called The Secret Team.
Let me interrupt you for our listeners who haven't seen it. Mr. X is the kind of deep throat character who gives all this secret information to Jim Garrison. And Mr. X is somebody who had worked high up in the military intelligence establishment.
And in fact, Fletcher Prouty is a retired colonel in the United States Air Force who was very high up in the military establishment, and he was one of the coordinators of providing military assistance to the CIA for its covert operations around the world. And so he is quite knowledgeable, and he wrote a quite interesting book in the 70s called The Secret Team. But since then, he's drifted far to the right and is taken up with speaking at events sponsored by people who say the Holocaust is a hoax. And I believe that the dilemma that we're presented with is that people who have these far right-wing and often anti-Jewish conspiracy theories are piggybacking on the film JFK, people like Prouty, Mark Lane, Victor Marchetti, And a whole range of people on the left who have picked up some of these conspiracy theories are in fact involved in promoting not only the specific views around the JFK assassination, but inevitably bringing in these ideas about, you know, secret oligarchies or Jewish elite banking control of the world into common discussion without being candid or frank about what they represent.
So what's the connection between Oliver Stone and Fletcher Prouty?
Well, Prouty was an advisor to the film. He's listed as an advisor at the end of the film. And of course, the character Mr. X is based primarily on Fletcher Prouty. And Stone praised Prouty's work in a New York Times op-ed piece. And I wrote a letter to Oliver Stone saying that, you know, I liked the film, actually. I thought it was a brilliant piece of filmmaking. But I had a problem with his inadvertent, I presume, promotion of people who are connected to these groups that really think that Jews control the world and goes off into these other arcane conspiracy theories that are essentially scapegoating conspiracy theories.
Do you think that Stone was aware of Prouty's connections to these other views?
No, because I've talked to Mr. Prouty and I've read other assertions by some of these people, and they misrepresent the nature of this network of groups that they work with. So I don't think Stone was aware of this, although he was made enough aware of it to distance himself from Prouty during the filming.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chip Relay. He's an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, and he specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. Another example that you've given of how the extreme right has tried to affect the thinking of the left is the Gulf War.
Yeah, during the Gulf War, there was a kind of a moment when groups on the far right and groups that opposed the war shared an opposition to the war, and that occurred across the political spectrum, and is entirely, you know, legitimate, and anti-war sentiment knows no political allegiance very often. However, what happened was that during the Gulf War crisis, groups which would include the Spotlight Liberty Lobby crowd, the Populist Party, and even the LaRouchians began to weave their way into anti-war groups, so much so that at one point there was a nationally televised cable program that included a spokesperson for LaRouche making assertions about the Gulf War. And you also saw people like Bo Greitz, who's running on the Populist Party ticket, beginning to talk about left-right coalitions to stop foreign intervention. And groups with as reputable kind of progressive credentials as the Pacifica radio stations began to air some of these people and their convoluted theories about the Gulf War, many of which were really drawn from these arcane conspiracy theories. And again, I think it's perfectly legitimate for these people to have airtime, but I think it's consistent with good radio station policy to let people know that they have some of these connections and that some of these ideas really represent discredited and unprovable assertions.
If you think that people on the extreme right want to either join with or influence the thinking of people on the left, what for?
Well, I can simply look to the writings and speakings of people like Bo Greitz. Greitz has been writing and touring the country giving radio interviews saying that there is no left and right, that the left and the right have to join together to smash the corrupt government, which is an interesting echo back to the Weimar period in Germany in the 30s and 20s when the same coalition was proposed, and it really didn't have too good an outcome, as many will remember, because when the left and the right joined together in Italy or in Germany, it built the fascist movements in those countries. Now, I hasten to add that this is merely an echo of that syndrome, but historically, the idea that the left and the right should join together and smash the central government has ended up with a far more repressive and brutal government that liquidated its enemies. So I don't think it's a good trade-off. I agree that the government is engaged in wrongdoing and there's tremendous repression, but the solution is not fascism.
What political areas do you think that the extreme right and the left are most likely to come together on?
Well, I'd say primarily government intelligence abuse, both the CIA and domestically the FBI, civil liberties, very often around very, very serious issues that need to be addressed. And in some cases, those coalitions are fine. You know, if you're a civil libertarian, it doesn't matter what your political stripe is. But you also see it around in the environmental movement. Interestingly enough, there in Germany especially, there's been a problem with far-right-wing neo-Nazi groups and in England as well, basically proclaiming themselves to be pro-environmental, because they are, and then bringing in their theories of racial nationalism into environmental groups. Now, to their credit, in Europe, these overtures have been overwhelmingly rejected, whereas in this country, I think there's a little more naivete about what fascism really is.
We're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories with Chip Raleigh. He's an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, and he specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Chip Raleigh is my guest, and we're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories. Now, another place that you've been finding conspiracy theories catching on is in certain African American groups, conspiracy theories about the Jews. What kind of theories and in which kind of groups are you talking about?
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of these theories come from the same well, which is essentially the white supremacist movement in the U.S., and they track back many years. And what we see in this country now is, unfortunately, some of the people around Minister Louis Farrakhan adopting some of these theories of Jewish control of the world. And it's gotten to the point where there's a new book out published by the Nation of Islam called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, which makes the assertion ultimately that Jews controlled the slave trade, which is simply not true. And so what you see, I think, is a syndrome where, because conditions in urban African-American communities are so terrible, and the political police repression is terrible, and the systematic exclusion from access to, you know, democracy and the quote-unquote American way of life is real, that you see this scapegoating coming out. And I want to make it very clear that my criticism is of what they're saying about Jews, but I absolutely agree that the conditions that are creating this agony and this anxiety and causing this kind of backlash and scapegoating are also very real. So you have to say both. That, for instance, in the early 80s, when the Farm Belt collapsed, you saw a number of farmers adopting these very same theories of Jewish banking control of the world. And it was because the farm economy had collapsed and these people's backs were against the wall. So you have to, I think it's important to twin that, because we didn't condemn all the farmers out of hand without looking at the social context. And I don't think it's fair to condemn the African American community as a whole for the excesses of a handful of black nationalists.
Gee, what a difficult job you have trying to clarify.
It's a real
political landmine that you're dealing with here, I think.
Yeah, it's a real problem, but it's historically, this is nothing new. I mean, you can look back throughout American history at, for instance, go back to the Salem witch hunts, which was essentially an attempt to reinforce a patriarchal religious order in which women had no power. And so women were scapegoated, essentially, for all that was wrong with the society back then, and they were declared witches and burned. You look at the anti-Catholic scares of the 1700s and 1800s, the anti-Masonic theories. Go to the Palmer raids, which are really anti-Italian. The Palmer raids were based on the idea that all Italians were anarchists and all anarchists had bombs, so we had to deport tens of thousands of Italians that were rounded up in December of 1919 and January of 1920. The Red Scare. I mean, this is a periodic moment that occurs throughout American political science, and we're witnessing the current manifestation of these scapegoating conspiracy theories.
Do you think that part of the roots of American conspiracy theory goes back to the John Birch Society and its Blue Book?
Well, not many people know what the Blue Book is, but the Blue Book was the book given to every entering member of the John Birch Society. Of course, you have to understand the Birch Society only came around in the mid-50s and reached its heyday in 1964 with the Goldwater campaign. It's important to differentiate here, because the Birch Society theories officially never embraced racialism or anti-Jewish conspiracy theory. And to their credit, they threw out people who were overtly racist and spun anti-Jewish theories. So the Birch theory is essentially the idea that insiders control the world and that all world governments are run by the same group of power brokers who are secret and operate through front groups like the Trilateralist Commission or the Bilderbergers or the, there's a number of others. Council on Foreign Relations is one of their bugaboos. So that certainly has had an effect, and a lot of the theories that have come out around JFK and the Gulf War and Iran-Contragate really have their roots in the Birch theories of insider elite control. If you believe in racialism and anti-Jewish conspiracy theory, which is the big dividing line in the American political right, and that would be like the Populist Party, the Spotlight, the Liberty Lobby, and that crowd, then the conspirators are all manipulated by Jews, rich, powerful Jews who are everywhere and, you know, evil. And if you don't believe in racialism and anti-Jewish theories, then you adopt sort of the Birch milieu, which is that it's very powerful banking interests, finance capital that control the world and put the Bolsheviks and Roosevelt in power, you know, essentially.
You've described Pat Buchanan and David Duke as two different strains of historical fascism. What do you mean by that?
Well, people forget that fascism is a relatively new phenomena that was based on the theory of racial nationalism. Not all strains of fascism were Hitlerite. Fascism actually started in Italy, and at the time had actually some support from labor unions and from the left through the idea of national socialism, and the idea that you could have a socialism based on a nation that itself was homogeneic based on either a culture or an ethnicity or a race, something that people shared biologically, essentially, or through some common heritage. And in the United States, the nativist movement of the 1800s, which was very anti-immigrant, sort of evolved into the modern American equivalent of fascist movement throughout the 1930s and 40s and 50s. It simply transmogrified over time. And so there actually is a strain of racial nationalism, which you can detect in reading Buchanan's columns, where he talks about the basis of all loyalty is essentially tribal or racial. And then you can move over to the more extreme wing of fascism, which is the supremacist wing, which believes not only should nations be constituted on a racial basis, which is also the belief, I hasten to add, of Reverend Louis Farrakhan, as well as the white supremacist movement, as well as certain very small factions within the Native American movement, the Warrior Society, which has been criticized by the traditionalist and the American Indian movement because of their racially exclusive view of nation. You can track that across the political spectrum and see that Buchanan represents a kind of heritage of fascism based on racial nationalism, and Duke represents the next step over into the neo-Nazi movement, where you talk essentially about not only racially segregated nations, but ones in which some people are intrinsically superior due to their biology. That's Nazism. That's the difference between fascism, which is racial nationalism, and Nazism, which is biological determinism.
I'm wondering if you ever meet somebody who sounds perfectly rational and you start talking to them about politics and you realize that they're deep into conspiracy theories.
Oh, all the time. I travel by train quite a bit, and it's surprising how many times I'll sit. I like to sit down and strike up conversations with a range of people. And I sat down on an Amtrak train from Chicago to Boston recently and ran into a person who wove this long, elaborate conspiracy theory about, you know, the oil industry controls the banks, which controls the environment. And so if the environmental movement ever wants to get anywhere, it's got to read the works of Eustace Mullins, who writes about the Federal Reserve. Well, I had read some of Mr. Mullins' work, which not only talks about the Federal Reserve, but pretty much encourages the liquidation of Jews on the planet. So it's astonishing how widespread this belief structure is throughout society. And most mainstream journalists never run into it, or if they do, they simply, you know, dismiss it as aberrant. But there's a surprising number of Americans who read The Spotlight, who read LaRouche's publications, and who listen to talk radio and hear these conspiracy theories spun 24 hours a day.
So to what extent are you being cast as a character in the conspiracies now by groups that you've been investigating?
Well, I've long been cast as that character. I have a large clip file of people, you know, discovering that I'm an, you know, assertions like I'm a deep cover FBI agent, or I've worked for the CIA, or my roots are in the Nazi movement, or the LaRouche people once said I was a Latvian spy, or I'm an agent of the grain cartel. I found that one fascinating. I don't know whether I'm supposed to be promoting Wheaties or something, but sure, I'm now part of the conspiracy, and so I've joined the iconography of the conspirators.
Do you ever worry about your safety?
Well, I get death threats from time to time, and I get my picture in some weird newspapers. You know, Tom Metzger once called for me and Lenny Zeskin, another researcher, people to get our picture so they could publish it. So, you know, I take some precautions. I live in a fairly secluded area. The end of dead end streets, you know. So I try and not take that in a way. I take it seriously, but not in a way that affects my lifestyle that much, you know. So I think it's part of the territory of researching these kinds of groups that are so passionate and so zealous about their beliefs. I've had people stake out my house and sue me and stuff like that, but, you know, here I am calling them neo-Nazis. What do I expect? I sort of have to give them a little room to be angry.
Chip Riley is my guest, and we're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories. I'm wondering if you're following a couple of the conspiracy theories that have been circulating in certain black neighborhoods, and I'm thinking of the theory that goes that AIDS was...
Jewish doctors inject black children with AIDS.
Well, actually, I hadn't heard it that way. I hadn't heard
okay.
Jews involved in it, but just that it was a kind of government plot
sure.
to cause genocide
right.
among blacks. And the other is similar for drugs. That, you know, drugs have been pushed largely in black neighborhoods to help keep black people down.
Well, I think in both cases, what you have is a classic inversion, which is where you have an objective reality, and the way you look at that situation is inverted. In other words, the fact that there are near-genocidal conditions in the black community is demonstrable statistically, given infant mortality rates, life expectancy, police brutality, incarceration rates. I think you can defend the idea that, you know, we as Americans should be ashamed of that track record, and that it has a devastating effect on the black and African-American, and in some cases, Hispanic communities. However, to invert that and then say that that's caused by some conscious plan, when in fact I argue it's the result of institutionalized racism, which is accepted by the average American, it's that inversion that I try to struggle against.
When you talk about inversion, do you mean, for instance, that instead of it being a conspiracy to kill the black community, it's more like critical neglect that
Absolutely.
Is responsible for the problem?
Sure. Well, what's responsible for the problem is racism.
And the racism causes the neglect.
Well, right. And it's the inversion which says that there was a conscious plan to do this, when in fact it's much more institutionalized and much more of an organic reality, which we should be ashamed of. But nonetheless, we're not going to solve it by trying to find some secret plan, because, you know, you're never going to find it. What we need to do is change the situation. And that's the ultimate danger of conspiracy theories. I think ultimately the dilemma is that what scapegoating and conspiracy theories allow each of us to do is not take responsibility for what's happening, not take responsibility for racism, not take responsibility for homophobia, not take responsibility for the economic disparities in the country, not take responsibility for the covert action and counterinsurgency policies of the U.S. government. And by simply saying we're not to blame, we can blame a secret team or a secret, you know, government or whatever, we're not taking responsibility for citizens for having elected government officials who have perpetrated these policies in a bipartisan manner for almost 50 years. So I think ultimately it's a mechanism to transfer responsibility off our own shoulders and ultimately pretend that we're not responsible when we as Americans are responsible.
Well, Chip Riley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Chip Riley is an analyst with the group Political Research Associates based in Boston. He specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Recent news stories about sexual abuse, rape, and the attack against abortion rights have focused the anger of many women. But what's the state of the women's movement? Coming up, we talk with feminist writer Deirdre English. Linguist S.I. Hayakawa and Dwight Bollinger died last week. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, compares the positions of these two men on the subject of free speech. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. With polls closed in Georgia, network projections have President Bush and Bill Clinton winning their respective primaries. CBS News has projected Clinton will gain a strong victory over Paul Tsongas, winning a large percentage of the black vote and blue-collar white vote in the Democratic primary. CBS also says that Pat Buchanan will have another strong showing in Georgia on the Republican side. Voters are taking part in primaries and caucuses in seven states today to choose 383 Democratic delegates and 198 Republican delegates. Next week is Super Tuesday, and primaries in eight states and nearly twice as many delegates to be chosen. President Bush has announced that he and Russian President Boris Yeltsin will hold a summit in Washington June 16th and 17th. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush made the announcement at the White House before departing for Chicago, where he addressed the National Association of Evangelicals. The president told his audience he supports voluntary school prayer and opposes abortion.
Faith, family. These are the values that sustain the greatest nation on earth. And to these values, we must add the infinitely precious value of life itself.
But campaign politics continue to bedevil the president. Today he is quoted in the Atlanta Constitution as saying he made a mistake when he broke his no new taxes pledge as part of the 1990 budget agreement. In his words, if I had to do it over, I wouldn't do it. Look at all the flack it's taking and its political grief. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Chicago.
The government's main economic forecasting gauge went up in January. It was the strongest gain in more than 6 months and comes on the heels of other promising economic reports. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The index of leading economic indicators rose 0.9% in January. That came as a surprise to most economists who had been predicting a smaller increase. The monthly index is designed to forecast economic activity 6 to 9 months in the future. In January, 7 of the 11 indicators that make up the index rose. For instance, stock prices were higher, businesses ordered more equipment, and there were more applications for building permits. Today's report is only one of several released recently that indicate the economy may be strengthening. Today, the Commerce Department also reported that new home sales rose in January, and yesterday it said that consumer and construction spending were also up. Most economists greeted these reports with guarded optimism. Most say it's still too early to tell whether the long-awaited recovery has finally arrived. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 15 points to close at 3,290.25 on volume of some 201 million shares. This is NPR News. Former East German leader Erich Honecker is back in Chile's embassy in Moscow tonight after being hospitalized for over 1 week. Honecker is said to be suffering from cancer. He has been in Moscow for a year now, and he sought refuge in the embassy after Russia threatened to expel him. Honecker is wanted in Germany on manslaughter charges, accused of ordering border guards to shoot those trying to flee East Germany. On Capitol Hill, the Senate is considering a bill that would reauthorize funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. There was controversy on the Senate floor today as Republicans tried to delay a vote on the bill and Democrats moved to speed it up. NPR's Maeve Magoran reports.
The bill under consideration would provide the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with $1.1 billion in federal funding between 1994 and 1996. Republican Senator Jesse Helms said in debate today he wants to hold public television and radio accountable for how they spend those funds. And Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole said public broadcasting has become too ideological.
Can anyone stand on this floor and claim that public broadcasting is not liberal? Nobody can make that claim. It is. And that's the real test. It's leaning so heavily to one side, it's starting to look like the Titanic.
But Democratic Senator Albert Gore accused the Republicans of holding up the vote on the reauthorization bill and trying to kill public broadcasting. The senators now have 30 hours to debate whether to proceed to a vote on the bill. I'm Maeve Magoran in Washington.
The largest car maker in the former Soviet Union is being sold to private investors. The maker of Volga cars and trucks will first become a joint stock company with all shares owned by the state. Then, according to the TASS news agency, the shares will be offered to employees and other investors. The plant now employs 100,000 workers. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Women all over America have been talking about the Clarence Thomas hearings, the Tyson and Kennedy Smith rape trials, and the attack against abortion rights. These stories have focused the anger of many women. So did the movie Thelma and Louise and Susan Faludi's bestseller Backlash. Yet many of today's angry women don't think of themselves as feminists and have never identified with the women's movement. So where is the women's movement today? We invited feminist writer Deirdre English to talk with us. She's a former editor of Mother Jones magazine, and she's now working on a TV series about the second wave of feminism. She recently reviewed Gloria Steinem's new book for the New York Times Sunday Book section. Steinem's book, Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem, discusses her own burnout and how she realized that in spite of her prominence as a feminist, she was still lacking in self-esteem. She offers many self-help options for women who need to increase their self-esteem. Deirdre English was troubled by this self-help emphasis, which she says might represent more of a retreat than an advance.
Well, what I found troubling about it was that it was too much of a self-help book for me, and I felt in a way that Gloria Steinem, who is someone who I respect and admire tremendously, but that I was saddened to see her emerging here as a follower in a kind of well-established tradition of self-help books for women, rather than in the guise that I prefer to see her in and where I think she's strongest, which is as a political leader of the women's rights movement. And even going farther than that, I think that these two schools of thought, you know, self-help versus political activism on behalf of women, offer very different answers to the kinds of questions about where women's lives are going. And sometimes very contradictory answers.
How are those answers contradictory?
Well, you know, for example, one of the things that Steinem says in her book, she talks about how women have got poor body images, and it's true. And so many women seem to feel that they're fat or ugly, or in some way there's something deformed about their bodies, and it's a major psychological issue for them. And she concentrates in the book on kind of offering ways that we could feel better about our body image. Well, I think a more feminist approach to that issue is to ask, why is this such a big issue for women and not such a big issue for men? And that something changing the way in which society responds to women might be an ultimately far more effective way of changing the way that we feel about ourselves.
Do you think that there needs to be a combination of both, of looking within and looking at larger social and political causes?
Well, I think that Steinem is saying that there needs to be a combination of both, so I certainly wouldn't want to exaggerate her position. She hasn't turned away from feminism. But in this book, my own sense of the book, I would say, is that it is a kind of an emotional release for her. She describes it that way herself, and she says that, you know, after over 20 years of intense activism, she needed to stop and take a breather and have some therapy and be kinder to herself. And I think that is all well and good, and one feels strongly that Gloria Steinem deserves that. Unfortunately, it in this book, she takes that and transforms it a bit too much for my taste into a political direction for women. After all, the book is a bestseller. She has been out there doing a tour of all major cities and speaking about these ideas and really promoting them. The book is filled with self-help exercises and an appendix with guided meditations that you can do. It is very prescriptive. And I think particularly because it is Gloria Steinem, because she is perceived as a leader, this book sets forth a set of ideas and asks us to emulate them as a direction for the 90s. Let's all stop and look within. Let's all work on our self-esteem. And I think that is a real problem as a political direction for women. I certainly am, you know, I'm not against self-esteem or therapy. And I've, you know, turned to therapists myself many times. And I, you know, think that breathing exercises and meditation and all kinds of things that Gloria Steinem recommends in this book are all fine things in themselves. What I am concerned about is the way in which self-help, recovery programs, the whole model of that's come out of the 12-step programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way in which personal, privatized recovery from a victimized status is becoming a social model in our country, in our culture. And I think too much supplanting a sense that we can change society.
So we're so busy concentrating on how we've been victimized and trying to overcome that sense of victimization, too busy focusing on that to focus more outwardly on larger social, political, feminist issues.
Well, it's not just too busy, but also that it is conceptualizing it as an individual problem. You know, I've been a victim and I need to recover, rather than how can I recover in a society that continuously victimizes not just me, but other people like me, whether that means women or African Americans or other minorities. And that that an individual recovery is, even if it's a partially possible, it's never completely possible, especially when you're talking about something like self-esteem, which is really so tied in to the affirmations that you get from your society. I mean, for example, even Gloria Steinem, I think, experienced this in a funny way when she talks in her book about wanting to be more self-accepting and stop bleaching her hair blonde and wearing less makeup and wearing flat shoes and being less clothes conscious. And she talks about all these things, I think, rightly as moves in the direction of greater personal self-acceptance. And that seems good. Then she goes out to have an interview and kind of introduces this new, less glamorous persona in an interview with someone who wrote about her in Vanity Fair. And she's put down in that interview. She's described as a matron, a little brown wren, and the writer complains that she has faint spots on her sweater.
Yes, right. That's right.
And in other words, she tries to introduce her more self-accepting, you know, new self, and she's shot down for it. And the clear message in the Vanity Fair piece is, "Hey, bring back the old Gloria. We like the blonde bombshell. Bring her back. You're making a big mistake here, Gloria." You know. Well, I think that's a kind of a paradigm for what happens to women in a society that does not support the kinds of changes that I think Steinem is asking for.
My guest is feminist writer Deirdre English. She's the former editor of Mother Jones magazine. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is feminist writer Deirdre English, and we're talking about the state of the women's movement. One criticism of the women's movement I've been reading is, the women's movement promised us the impossible. They said that we could have it all, that we could have the career and the family and have it all in balance and be really happy. And I wonder if you think that that's a fair criticism, if you think that the women's movement ever, you know, pretended to promise that.
No, you know, I don't. I mean, the women's movement, feminism is not something you can order off a menu, you know, with all the trimmings. And, of course, I think that's a very unfair criticism to lay on to the sort of pioneering leaders of the movement, women like Gloria Steinem. They let us down. I mean, in the sense, Sally Quinn in the Washington Post wrote that article recently, blaming the leaders for not having delivered the revolution. Well, it just doesn't work that way. But, you know, on another level, a more visionary level, feminism actually does offer a vision of having it all for both men and women. And that's one of its greatest strengths. It offers the vision of men who can really reconnect on a fundamental level with respect for life and love of others and nurturance and openness, involvement with their families. Men don't need to be status objects and career-driven workaholics constantly fighting for status in hierarchies. And men can have true romantic love, only really after the feminist revolution. That's always been one of the promises of feminism. Feminism has always had a deep strain of romanticism, arguing that only when men and women are truly equal can they truly love one another. Only when you eliminate dominance and subservience from their relations. So feminism offers us great values. And yes, it offers women the opportunity to use their bodies and their minds to the fullest.
When you look around, where do you look for the force behind the women's movement now? I mean, is there a women's movement? How important is the National Organization for Women, which you know, of course, still exists and is going strong? But is that the center of the women's movement?
There is no center, and I think that's okay. Maybe that's really good. It's a measure of how widespread the women's movement is, and kind of means that if mistakes are made in one area, that's okay because other areas are going strong. I mean, even during these doldrum years that we've talked about, there have been incredible achievements. Women have been hitting the glass ceiling on the one hand, and yet other women have been succeeding in their own, starting their own businesses. We have seen backlash and regression in the area of abortion rights, and yet we've seen pioneering new legislation and changes in police practice in the way that rape is handled, battered women cases are handled, and obviously in sexual harassment. These big publicized cases like Anita Hill's and Patricia Bowman's have been lost, but consciousness has been raised. So it's there's no one clear snapshot that you can take that says, you know, that the line on the chart is going up or going down. It's chaotic. Social change is chaotic. But I think the overwhelming sense now is that the women's movement is out there Yes, it's looking for leaders. It's looking for new leaders, and getting some, and craving others, especially ones who would run for office. But it's gathering its forces. Feminism is like a wave building right now. You can really sense it.
How much of your writing now is about women's issues?
A great deal of it, sometimes more than I wish. You know, I don't always want to think that this is my topic. I'm interested in everything about life, and yet the urgency of and the intellectual fascination for me of the gender revolution constantly calls to me.
What are you working on now?
I'm actually working on a television series about the second wave. The working title of this series, it's a four-part series, the working title is The Second Wave, An Unfinished Revolution.
We only have a couple minutes left, but I'm going to change the subject on you here briefly. I've heard that your house burned down in the Oakland fire.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Do you have a place to live now?
Yes. yeah, it's definitely, you know, I and the man that I live with have moved into a place, and that's okay. And actually, it's even, I must say, nice to have, you know, empty bookshelves and lots of shelf space.
Empty bookshelves because all your books were burned, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I felt crowded in my old house. I didn't have enough closet space. Well, you know, when all your things burn, that isn't a problem anymore.
You're saying there's something liberating so, about losing everything you
a
own?
Little bit, yeah. A little bit. That aspect of it is kind of nice. Just living, I feel since the fire, I've been living essentially out of, you know, with things I could pack in one suitcase. And that does give me a certain sense of freedom. It's like the conflagration just, you know, burned up my past. And now I have a certain sense of freedom and an opportunity to reinvent myself that comes out of it. This is not to say that I recommend the experience. you know, it was devastating for many people, and for me, it was devastating in that I lost my 4.5 years of research.
Oh, on the TV series or on
a
book?
Yeah, on the basically research that was for a book and was being used for this television series.
So what are you doing?
And I lost all my journals, and I lost all my family photographs, and I lost my father's letters to me, which my father was a very literate and articulate man who wrote me beautiful, beautiful letters, and I had always saved them, and I had always thought that someday I would write something based on them, and that's gone now. So that is what really has hurt.
Well, I wish you the best.
And, yeah, well, thank you very much.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Deirdre English is a feminist writer and the former editor of Mother Jones Magazine. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. On this election day, NPR's Joe Maglino looks ahead to Super Tuesday, 1 week from now, and reports on the issues facing the voters of Florida, education, health care, and unemployment. The Voter Education Project, based in Atlanta, is practically out of business. It dates back 30 years, has had a great deal of success in registering black voters, but now support is practically stopped. Foundations are more interested, it said, in issues of homelessness and abortion. Robert Siegel talks with the folks in Umiat, Alaska, the coldest place in the United States, and I'll talk with Will Steger, one of the leaders of the International Transantarctic Expedition, ending in March of 1990.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Part of what linguists do is set standards for how language is used and tolerated in a society. Two noted American linguists with contrasting styles died last week. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on their careers.
When former Senator S.I. Hayakawa died last week at 85, the San Francisco Chronicle described him as one of the nation's specialists in semantics and linguistics, and the New York Times called him a noted scholar. That's probably pushing things a bit. But Hayakawa lived a life in language, and it took him on a remarkable course. He was an obscure professor of English in 1941 when he wrote a surprise bestseller called Language in Action. It was a popularization of the quirky theories of the Polish philosopher Alfred Korzybski, who held that social pathologies are the results of an uncritical acceptance of the patterns of logic that are implicit in our speech. Hayakawa's book is far from serious linguistics, but it's engaging, and it deserves real credit for awakening a lot of Americans to the insidiousness of totalitarian propaganda a decade before Orwell developed the theme in earnest. Language in Action taught a healthy skepticism about the mischief that language can do. But as time went by, Hayakawa's mistrust of language seemed to deepen, to the point where he came to believe that some forms of speech were too dangerous to be permitted. As president of San Francisco State University, he came to national prominence during the student unrest of 1968, when the media broadcast pictures of him jumping on top of a platform to rip out the wires of an amplifying system being used at a rally of student strikers. He became a symbol of hard-nosed suppression of campus activism. In 1976, he parlayed that reputation into a Senate seat. After he retired from the Senate in 1982, he devoted himself to a campaign to make English the official language of the United States. That was how I met him a few years later, when we found ourselves on opposite sides in a Stanford University debate about the English-only question. Perhaps he'd mellowed by then, but I saw little of his celebrated feistiness. He was courtly to me, and polite even to the angry students who tried to beard him in the question period. But the mistrust remained. He spoke of the need to prohibit foreign language billboards and television programs. He warned that language minorities could become breeding grounds for sedition and political separatism. He seemed to have lost the faith that people in a free society could make the right decisions about language of their own accord. The Times ran another respectful obituary when Dwight Bollinger died in the same week as Hayakawa. But Bollinger's loss was mostly noticed in the small field of linguistics. The irony here is that Bollinger was the genuine article, one of the most distinguished semanticists of the age, with an uncanny ear for the nuances of words. Of course, he spent most of his life in academic cloisters like Harvard and USC, writing scholarly books and papers. His only foray into electoral office was to serve as president of the Linguistic Society of America and a few other professional societies. But he also believed that language was too important to be left a purely academic preoccupation. In a wonderful popular book called Language, the Loaded Weapon, he wrote that the manipulation of language is the most devastating form of social control of our time. At times, the book sounds like Hayakawa's Language in Action, and in fact, Bollinger's one of the few linguists I know of who's discussed Hayakawa's work seriously. The difference is that Bollinger never lost faith that the remedy for the abuses of speech was more speech. He wrote that people had to reassert the public ownership of language. It should take its place alongside of diet, traffic safety, and the cost of living as something that everybody thinks about and talks about. I don't know why Bollinger's popular writings about language never got the wide attention that Hayakawa's Language in Action did. Maybe it's because he lacked Hayakawa's gifts as a controversialist. It would be hard to imagine him interrupting somebody he disagreed with, much less pulling the plug on them. Nor was he much of a hand at the keening derision of the pop grammarians. He did the best he could with civility and good sense, and I suppose he won as large a readership as he could reasonably have expected. Perhaps every age gets the linguist it deserves.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mob Girl, a woman's perspective on life inside organized crime. We'll talk with journalist Teresa Carpenter. Her new book tells the story of a woman who lived in the underworld, kept her status through sexual favors, and turned government informant. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.